Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is American Grand Strategy. With me to discuss what grand strategy means and what role it has played in U.S. history are Beverly Gage, Christopher McKnight Nichols, and Andrew Preston. Beverly is Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University and Director of Yale's Brady Johnson Program in Grand Strategy. She is the author of The Day Wall Street Exploded, A Story of America in Its First Age of Terror. She is at work on a book titled G-Man, J. Edgar Hoover and the American Century, which will be coming out next year. Chris is the Director of the Center for the Humanities and the Sandy and Elva Sanders Eminent Professor in the Honors College at Oregon State University. He has written or edited 6 books, most notably Promise and Peril, America at the Dawn of a Global Age. Andrew is Professor of American History at the University of Cambridge, where he is a Fellow of Clare College. He is currently serving as President of the Society for Historians of American Foreign Relations. He has written 8 books on American diplomatic history, including Sword of the Spirit, Shield of Faith, Religion in American War and Diplomacy. He is currently at work on a book on the history of the idea of national security in the United States. Beverly is contributor to, and Chris and Andrew are co-editors with Elizabeth Borgwatt, of the new book, Rethinking American Grand Strategy, which Oxford University Press has just published. Beverly, Chris, and Andrew, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Sounds great.
I want to first congratulate you on the volume. It brings together a lot of great historians, Hal Brands, Charlie Adell, Mary Dudziak, Jeff Engel, Adrian Len Smith, and Fred Logoval, among others. And I want to really begin sort of with the title and ask a question, and perhaps I could direct it toward Beverly, since you are the director of the Program on Grand Strategy at Yale. And Beverly, can you just tell us what actually is grand strategy?
Well, that is an excellent question. I think for even the contributors of this volume, it's not at all straightforward what we're talking about when we talk about grand strategy. You know, as a kind of traditional term, it really comes out of the early 20th century, particularly out of British imperial traditions, and it suggests that there is a way for high policymakers, particularly in situations of war, to coordinate all of the resources at their disposal. So not only military resources, economic resources, cultural resources, diplomatic resources. So I think that's the traditional definition. The way that we think about grand strategy in the Grand Strategy Program at Yale, and I think in this volume, is in slightly broader terms, which is to say, might have something to do with foreign policy, but it can also be thought of as a kind of method for thinking about really large scale, major challenges, thinking about the relationship between means and ends and some of the obstacles to getting where you want to go.
Okay, so Beverly, I have to ask my immediate follow-up question, because I went to graduate school, albeit a long time ago. No one ever talked about grand strategy. This is back in the 80s, sort of pre with grand strategy becoming popular. What distinguishes grand strategy from good old-fashioned plain strategy?
Well, I think there is an ambition to have it distinguished by scale. So you add that word grand. Now, that can be a benefit. It can also be a problem. So some people would say grand strategy is just a slightly pretentious way of doing strategy. But as we think about it in the classes that I teach, it really is an attempt to stand back a little from very particular areas of expertise where strategy might be the relevant category. You might have military strategists, you might have foreign policy strategists, you might have political strategists. And I think grand strategy is attempting to step back and do the biggest picture possible, because in many of the challenges that we're facing in foreign policy and elsewhere, that's actually what you need.
Can I follow up with you, Andrew? I'm just curious. When you sort of think about grand strategy, and if you have a different view than Beverly just laid out, put it on the table. But I'm wondering, is grand strategy an option only for great powers, or is grand strategy something open up to other countries as well?
Well, first, I wouldn't disagree with the definition that Bev outlined. That sounded really compelling to me. And one of the things that comes out of the Yale program, and it always has, is thinking about strategy in very grand terms, as in it's more capacious, it's not just military, which is the traditional view of strategy. And it's the traditional view of grand strategy. But it's not just about winning wars, but it's about shaping the peace. And it's about integrating a number of various factors. And whether smaller powers or middle powers can have a grand strategy, I think they probably could for maybe regional personal concerns or concerns that are more confined to their own interests. But I really do think that you have to be a great power to have a grand strategy, because having a grand strategy, if it's about winning wars, but also shaping the peace, it's about shaping an external environment. And not very many states can do that, at least beyond their own immediate neighborhood. So I think if we wrote a book that was called Rethinking Canadian Grand Strategy, we wouldn't be having this conversation and nobody would be reading the book. Probably not even people in Ottawa would be reading the book. So I think you really have to be looking at the US or China.
No offense to my Canadian friends. I want to go on
record.
No,
I can say that. I'm a Canadian myself, even though I live in the UK now. So that's always my favorite example because I can get away with it, I think. Although I know, I'm sure I won't be able to get away with it. I'm sure I'll get in a lot of trouble for that.
So Andrew, am I right to think that over the last decade or so, talk about grand strategy has become more popular, more articles about grand strategy? And if I'm right in that sort of assessment, and it's not merely a function of my poor reading habits, any explanations for why grand strategy is enjoying this sort of renaissance here in the United States?
Yeah, the last 10, 15 years or so, it's just exploded in popularity. And you find business leaders talking about grand strategy. You find leaders in all sorts of different fields of life, not just in the military, not just in the Foreign Service, not just in Congress or the White House, talking about grand strategy. I'm not really sure. I mean, I'm sure Bev can speak to this better than I can. I know that Yale was ahead of the curve in the late 90s, early 2000s. Yale set up its grand strategy program. I think that's right. And it was kind of just ahead of the curve. And it had a cachet to it because people weren't sure what grand strategy was. But if you read Jeffrey Parker, if you read Michael Howard, if you read Paul Kennedy, you know, this idea of grand strategy starts to emerge and people got really excited about that. And then it just seemed to take off beyond the academy and beyond the military.
Chris, I want to come to you and I want to sort of locate our conversation now in actual American history, which is, you know, 2+ centuries. And I guess I'm left with the question, has the United States ever had a grand strategy as we're hearing it defined right now?
Sure. I think that it has. First, I want to interject because I think your question to Andrew is a great one. And I would suggest that there's sort of two key moments to understanding grand strategy in discourse in the US and arguably in sort of the Anglo sphere. And if you can do this by searching keywords and looking at political documents, and roughly the late 1930s into the late 1940s was the heyday of the use of the term grand strategy, and that it overlaps so clearly with the rise of the US as a world power and the reshaping of the world system, Bretton Woods, et cetera, the UN. It seems to indicate kind of how policymakers were using this term to do the strategic thought that Bev was talking about. Policy plans, matching long-term ends to limited kinds of means, necessarily limited because they're not unlimited, but the aspirations to reshape the world order are as grand as they get, right? And then the other moment of this was coming out of the Cold War, that you saw a lot of people talking about a need for grand strategy because what had seemed to function throughout the Cold War, and we could debate, you know, the enormous costs of the proxy conflicts and other things, but the relative peace, you could argue, of the Cold War seemed to be fractured, you know, circa 89, 90, 91. And then you see a sort of policy search for grand strategy in that era. So the archetypal grand strategy is, of course, containment. George Kennan had a number of iterations of this. We could spend the entire podcast going through what he thought about the concept of containment. But in its most reductive form, containment, the U.S. approach to limiting Soviet expansion without engaging in a hot conflict, is the archetypal grand strategy. If that one doesn't fit any of the definitions that we see out there, then there's no such thing historically. And then other ones, one of the things that I think is really great about the book and some of our conversations are about grand strategies when the U.S. was a weak power, that the U.S. had to match its long-term ambitions, the schemes to be the greatest democracy in the world, with its really fraught passage through the world, you know, as an early republic. It was surrounded by enemies, domestic and foreign, and how to deal with that necessitated kinds of grand strategies.
Bev, I'm curious, as we have this conversation, would something like Washington's great rule of conduct, sort of the guiding light that sort of drove American foreign policy for the first at least century, would that qualify as a grand strategy? The idea that we wanted to trade with everybody but didn't want to become entangled. Is that a grand strategy or is that just a label we give to what U.S. policymakers did for a century or so?
Well, though I teach a class called Grand Strategy, I try not to actually get too stuck in labeling what qualifies as a grand strategy and what doesn't qualify as a grand strategy.
Can I interrupt you, Bev, and ask you why?
Well, because I think the term is most useful sort of as a set of ambitions more than it is as a fixed category. So we take, in my class, an extremely capacious view of what grand strategy is. And so we look not only at foreign policy, or even as you're suggesting, you know, with the Washington example, at kind of big visions, right? Which is something that you could say is somewhat interchangeable with grand strategy, though I think they are not the same thing. But we also try to bring in your grand strategies from below, right? So not just to be looking at grand strategy as something that states do, but grand strategies as something that a social movement might think about that's trying to tackle some very, very large problem and trying to bring in a conversation about strategy there. So both because I think the term itself has no fixed definition and there's a little bit of just sort of territoriality about saying that's a grand strategy and that's not a grand strategy, but also because I think some of the most creative exchanges can happen when you're not too fixed on exactly what it is. That said, I do think a strategy is different from a vision or an idea, right? Because a strategy, whether we're going to call it grand or not, is at least in part about the how. So it's not just about what the guiding idea ought to be, but then about the ways in which one might get there. And I think what's exciting about doing grand strategy in an academic environment is that students tend to spend a lot of time thinking about the what, and they don't actually get as much of a chance to think about the how. So I'd give you a yes and a no on your Washington question.
Then, Bev, how do you think about the how?
Well, I think it's part about setting up that big vision. You know, most traditionally, as we've said, in the area of military and foreign policy, but not necessarily. And then thinking about what the means are that are actually at your disposal to get there, to move toward this vision or this goal as you might wish. I think limits and obstacles are probably the biggest thing to think about. John Gaddis, who established the Yale Grand Strategy Program, and Chris was referring to his, I think, now sort of widely accepted, almost conventional definition, is this disconnect between unlimited aspirations and limited means. And so the how part is really about those limited means. Now, your means might be vast, right? If you're the president of the United States, your means are truly vast, but they are not unlimited. And if you are an ordinary citizen activist, your means are much more limited, but they still exist and they're worth thinking through. What's the relationship between legal strategies and mass mobilization strategies and other forms of pressure strategy to get what you want?
Andrew, I want to come back to you, and I really want to tackle the question of where grand strategies come from. Because as I read a lot of articles about grand strategy, they tend to locate grand strategies or associate grand strategies with individuals. Chris mentioned George Kennan. I often hear people who talk about the 19th century invoke Albert Thiermahan and his theory of sea power. Some people might say, and I think there's a piece in your volume that argues about Wilson is laying out a grand strategy. So I'm left wondering, is that what grand strategy is? That there's just some really super smart person who sort of sits down and writes a piece and that defines the grand strategy? Is it something that has a broader source instead of roots?
Well, there always is that person who sort of does write it all down and they'll get the credit for devising some grand strategy. And so people like Kennan are called the father of containment. And, you know, those people are not unimportant. You do need someone to sometimes put the pieces together and to put the puzzle pieces into the puzzle and figure it all out. And then, of course, to come up with a way of making it comprehensible to other people, of saying, here's what we should be doing. And so you do have a Kennan, or you do have a Kissinger, or you do have a Mahan come along and put it all together. And that's why we still read them. But I think they're definitely part of the process, but they're more reflective of a much more complex, wider process that, as Bev said, can come from the bottom up. It can come from the top down. It's almost always a mix of the two. There might be pressure from the top down, there might be pressure from the bottom up, and they'll be drawing on, coming from either direction, people will be drawing on any number of different sources, cultural or in terms of literature or theory or economic conditions, whatever you have. And coming up with a grand strategy, often in a time of crisis, is that kind of iterative process of figuring things out, of figuring out where we go from here. How do we solve this problem? But why are we trying to solve this problem aside from the immediate problem that faces us? We need to win this war. We need to overcome this crisis. But what do we want after that crisis? crisis? What do we want the world to look like? And that's where grand strategy comes in. And certainly something like containment, as Chris said, would qualify without question. But to think that containment is, you know, just sort of comes out of the mind of George Kennan, it would be not giving it its proper due.
Let me draw you out in a specific case here, Andrew. In your contribution to the volume, you write about a gentleman who I suspect most people listening to this podcast have never heard. And that's a gentleman named Edward Mead Earle, who was at the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton for a number of years. I guess he died in 1954. And you sort of portray him as sort of consciously trying to create sort of a vision of America in the world. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was a classic moment in 1939, 40, 41, when it's a really fluid moment where you've got the world crisis, the U.S. is faced with some difficult choices, but it's not yet pressed into a war of self-defense. It's pretty much every other great power in the world was facing, or, you know, they were launching a war of offense like Germany and Japan were doing. And so the U.S. actually had the luxury of deciding what it should do in this 1939, 40, 41 period. This is before Pearl Harbor, obviously. And at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, Edward Mead Earle gathered together economists and historians, political scientists, sociologists, and they just met week after week to discuss not only the immediate problem facing the world and facing the United States and what the United States should do about it, but how people should be reconceiving of these problems, how they should be thinking about these problems. It's an historian's dream when you get into the archives of the Earle Seminar at Princeton, and the folders are labeled things like grand strategy or national security or capitalism. And there are these eggheads sitting around the table who are the smartest people of their day saying, here's what this means. And they're intentionally, self-consciously inventing terms. Now, grand strategy as a term or national security as a term existed before the Earle Seminar, but not, they weren't in common usage, and they didn't have the usage that we give them to today. And so when I look at Earle, I look at his seminar on national security and the seminar on grand strategy and how they said, this is how we're now going to frame these issues as ones of grand strategy. So it's not just the U.S. We need to get involved because we need to defend a potential attack against the territorial homeland of the United States. I mean, that wasn't going to happen, right? So they're thinking, well, why should the U.S. get involved in this conflict? Well, the U.S. needs to get involved in this conflict in order to completely reset how the international system will work so that it works to the benefit of the United States. So the questions become more than just about the immediate how. They become about big why questions. And for that reason, I found Earle to be really, really interesting. And then on top of that, at the same time, at that time, he was also writing about strategy. And he was the editor of a really major, also big fat landmark book that I think might still be in print in its fourth or fifth or sixth edition about makers of modern strategy. And so he's thinking about these things at this time. So that's why I found him incredibly interesting.
Chris, did you want to jump in here?
I did, yeah, because I think that's a great example of one of the sort of what you might argue are the domestic factors or potentially domestic factors that influence grand strategy. And that's another thing that I think historians writing about this subject, as Bev was just describing to teaching about the subject, really are trying to emphasize. That's something that I think we three at least agree on. So there are a number of examples of this. In the Cold War, the classic one is the amicus briefs filed by the State Department for decisions like the Brown ruling, right? Saying, look, American racial injustices at home undermine U.S. foreign policy, and the two are inherently wedded together, right? You can't have an effective U.S. foreign policy or a grand strategy to defeat the Soviet Union while you're having, you know, lynchings on the front page of Time magazine, right? So that's a pretty obvious one. But similar questions that really get at enduring issues in American democracy are also there from the start. So racism and race are there. The foreign policy of the slave powers, the Southern powers who are in Congress, who really dominate Congress through the first several generations of American democracy, push a kind of domestic, you know, racial capitalism system or proto-capitalist system in domestic and foreign policy. They have things like the gag rule in Congress, right? So they prevent meaningful abolitionist or transnational action to stop the slave trade in the U.S. And that's a big piece of American foreign policy. You can think about that too in the Civil War moment and diplomacy related to that. Should the Confederacy be recognized, say, by the U.K.? And we could talk more about some of these, but the domestic factors that shape foreign policy are something we also see today, and they shape grand strategies. I think that's really important in understanding the world around us because these historical shaping patterns are very much there. One example, just leave you with in thinking about this, is Black Lives Matter, which, you know, as it rose up in the Obama years and then through Trump, became a worldwide movement, but it started in the U.S. So how do we understand that? It has sweeping ambitions globally. It does have limited means, but those means are expanding. And so if you go back to a traditional definition, say Clausewitz saying, you know, tactics are the art of using troops in battle, but strategy is the art of using battles to win the war, then what's Black Lives Matter's version of battles to win the war? It's not warfare per se. It's a whole lot of other kinds of actions, and it's much more ground up than top down.
It's also not only a matter of domestic politics and foreign policy being deeply intertwined, right? What kinds of institutions are available to make an effective foreign policy? I think, as we've seen over the last 4 years in pretty stark and straightforward ways, domestic politics and grand strategy or foreign relations are intimately intertwined. But I think it's also really important for foreign policymakers to have a serious sense of understanding about social movements, particularly over the last 30 or 40 years, because one of the things that we've seen is that it's actually protest movements, often nonviolent protest movements, that have been the drivers of really revolutionary change in some cases, regional instability in other cases. And so without understanding those dynamics and really taking them into account, and also thinking about social movements as things that have strategies of their own, I don't think that we can make very good foreign policy. So even if we're just talking about a kind of top-down grand strategy, taking some sense and having some read and understanding on these forces from below, how activists might be thinking about strategy seems really important as well.
My takeaway from this conversation we're having right now certainly amplifies what I think is one of my takeaways from reading the various contributions to your volume, which is that it's important to think about grand strategy as being about more than military assets or being about more than the balance of military and diplomatic assets. It is, maybe for a lack of a better term, Washington phrase of whole of government, though maybe it's better to say whole of society. Would that be a fair read, Chris?
I think so. Yeah. One of the things we emphasize is the sort of what theorists argue is the strategic culture or umbrella in which these decisions are made and that they're inextricable. And so it's a kind of holistic, interconnected way of matching long-term ends with short-term necessarily limited means. So I think that's exactly right. And there are a number of other vectors of this that are useful. I mean, one of the more prescient things that we've been talking about, the historians, at least in this conversation, has been the need for a global public health grand strategy. Well before the pandemic, the Yale program, in fact, has been pioneering some of that. It's very clear right now that we've devoted a lot more resources globally to the war on terror than we have to the war on viruses, to our tremendous detriment as a nation state and as an international community.
Just jumping on what Bev and Chris just said, the ideas about grand strategy aren't just military, but the nature of the threat is changing. And they're not even necessarily threats. The nature of just how societies change, and especially in a globalized world, those threats, those opportunities, those challenges are so integrated and they're so complex, be they about public health, as Chris just mentioned, about climate change, about economic crisis, about social inequality, about migration and refugee flows, about all sorts of things that we might not think of as necessarily strategic. Those things are strategic. And we have to think about them in ways that aren't purely about foreign policy or military policy.
As I listened to the three of you talking, it sort of solidifies for me something that jumped out when I was rereading The Sources of Soviet Conduct recently. Author again, George Kennan, you know, his famous X article in Foreign Affairs in July of 1947. And it's mostly remembered for containment. We have to sort of meet the Soviets wherever they want to push. But he also wrote that the outcome of the U.S. struggle with the Soviet Union would be determined by Washington's ability to, and let me quote him here, create among the peoples of the world generally the impressions of a country which knows what it wants, which is coping successfully with problems of its internal life and with the responsibilities of a world power. Now, that isn't a point that he developed at great length in that article, but I think it sort of indicates or highlights something that you're talking about, sort of trying to think more broadly, more capaciously, if I may say, about sort of America's role in the world, that it's not simply number of aircraft carriers or number of diplomats you send to international conferences. Bev, I want to come back to you and sort of based on sort of your thinking about these issues, if you were to have an hour with President Biden and he was to ask you about grand strategy and how we should think about it in his current situation, what advice would you offer?
I think that I would say that right now, one of the biggest challenges, as you were suggesting, for the United States in having any sort of effective grand strategy in the world is figuring out its own domestic politics. And that over the last 4 years, we've seen real damage done, obviously not by Joe Biden, but that is lasting damage, and that to have any sort of real credibility on the world stage, age, people have to believe that the United States has some stability, some justice, some right principle on its side, and some ability to effectively manage its own society before the United States is going to have anything other than, you know, the kind of baldest forms of power and influence around the world. So I think that we are at a moment, this has always been true. It was certainly true during the Cold War. It was certainly true in the 1990s. But I think that we're at a moment where it is more true than ever that what happens domestically in the United States is being watched on the world stage, and that any grand strategy and any hopes, whether you're talking about an economic grand strategy, a military grand strategy, really has to take those pieces into account.
So, Andrew, what would you say in that meeting with President Biden after Beverly's just finished?
I wouldn't have much left to say because I think she put it extremely well. I think that's without doubt that strategy isn't just simply an external policy that the United States is going to project onto the rest of the world. The strategy will come from within. And as you said, when you were quoting from Kennan's X article in 1947, he realized that in 1947. And people before Kennan realized that too. But because of the nature of how societies are now globally interconnected, how societies have become so much more complex because of social media, because of rapid fire economic flows, because of AI and all sorts of other sorts of challenges, that need to be more holistic, that need to be more integrative in our thinking is even more pressing. The other thing I would say is that it's not just the United States that has to take into consideration what goes on at home in devising its grand strategy and how it interacts with other states. All the great powers or middle powers or whatever we want to call them have the same challenge. And those challenges are increasing in intensity and scope and scale as well. That's absolutely true for China. No matter, I mean, anyone who thinks that Xi Jinping is simply this grandmaster who controls Chinese society and it just dances to his tune, that's just not how China works. It works differently from the United States, but other countries will also have to balance these increasing pressures in this interplay between, for lack of better terms, the domestic and the foreign. Although, as Bev said, it's much more complicated than that. And that's true of all different societies.
Let me just draw you out on that a little bit, Andrew. And I'm going to ask you this question because, one, you're living in the United Kingdom currently. Number two, you're a Canadian. On that aspect of sort of American domestic success, health, and the rest, does the United States, in your view, have a good story to tell the rest of the world? Can we come back from the scenes that people have seen on television of Charlottesville, of the death of George Floyd? Is that something that can be remedied? Or, as I often hear from my friends who live on the continent, Europe has sort of started marching in a different direction. And I understand that there are some people in Great Britain who don't necessarily see themselves as part of Europe. So we'll put that aside. But I just want to get a sense, sort of from your vantage point, of whether an effort of the United States to reinvent itself, and in some ways we are a country that likes to reinvent ourselves, does it have a chance of success? Do people want to listen or hear it?
Well, 52% of the people in the country I'm living in now don't see themselves as European. So, and that's the direction we're going in. And I would answer your question about the United States by saying that all countries have their extreme problems. Sometimes they're more extreme than at other moments. But, you know, living in the UK right now, after the last 3 or 4 years, we've been going through our own similar type of moment that the US has been going through. It's been different, but it's similar. We went from a referendum over Scotland where the country almost broke apart. I mean, if you think of maybe California or Illinois having an independence referendum, and it's razor thin, and it might be that actually Illinois is going to leave the union. And what do we do about that? Well, the last time you guys went through that, it, you know, there was a lot of bloodshed in the 1860s in solving that question. And then we had the Brexit referendum. Then we've had, I mean, extreme economic turbulence. And then we've had one of the worst bouts of COVID in the world. And I think Britain is still at the top of countries that have a population of larger than 15 or 20 million. Britain is still per capita the worst affected country in the world for COVID. So we've had a lot of crises as well. And societies go through this. And so the point I'm trying to make is that when people in Britain look at the United States, yes, there are a lot of critics. Yes, there are a lot of people who are just blind champions of the U.S., but I think they understand that the U.S. has gone through a lot of challenges, that it's coming through those challenges, and that it's dealing with those challenges. And I think what people admire about the U.S. is that the process of dealing with those challenges is right up front. It's right out there in the open. You can follow it. You kind of know what's going on. And people feel like there's a stake in American society. They certainly do here in Britain. I don't know about the continent, but that's definitely true in Canada and Britain. I think it's true in most other countries. So it's a long answer to your very good question about whether, I mean, people pay attention to what's going on in the U.S. People do still see the U.S. as an example. They don't necessarily want to follow the example that the U.S. sets a lot of times. What really strikes me when I talk to people in the U.K. about anti-Americanism and asking if they have negative opinions or negative views of the U.S., why that is. is. And you expect, at least I expect it to be something about capitalism or something about foreign policy. And it's almost always, especially if the respondent is younger, it's almost always about gun violence, almost always, without question. So people realize there are problems, but there's also a sense that the U.S. is dealing with those problems, and it will come through those problems in fine enough shape.
Chris, let me come to you, but change up the question a little bit. May not affect your answer. Let me reframe the question. Rather than giving advice to Joe Biden, if you were giving advice to Joe Biden's national security team as they're all running around trying to find a theory of the case that is going to animate what the administration does, what advice would you give them?
So we're historians here, and we would drop, I would suggest dropping a line down in the water and plumbing the depths of some of the sort of themes that have been most useful in uniting grand strategy in the past. And perhaps some are unexpected. So I would pick some examples and things to think about that they're probably not thinking about today. One would be something like reproductive rights. Another would be about humanitarian relief. And I would suggest that they think about, you know, it's gun violence, racism, some of these things that absolutely the U.S. needs to put into its foreign policy and security calculus are there. But there are others that could be leading wedge issues for the U.S. and the world in thinking about security in a more capacious way, in a, dare I say, grand strategic way. And I would probably put at the top of my list a new partnership model of vaccine diplomacy. So if we're seeing the EU and we're seeing fragment on how they deal with this, we're seeing Russia and China attempt a much more coercive version of vaccine diplomacy. If the U.S. actually partnered cooperatively without the sort of usual strings that are attached in the American way of unilateralism, I think you could make some enormous strategic inroads around the world within a year. And then that would allow you to open to some of those other wedge areas, reproductive rights questions and humanitarian relief. And as you open up those areas, then you can achieve different kinds of strategic concerns, I would think, more specific in the sort of statecraft realm.
I will say in the grand strategy program at Yale, one of the really fun things is that we do try to have these conversations that allow people to share kind of academic knowledge and practitioner knowledge. So you asked about Joe Biden's national security team. Well, national security advisor Jake Sullivan has been teaching in the grand strategy program at Yale for the last 4 years while he's been out of office. And so one of the things that we actually try to do is to give policymakers like that, particularly in their mid-career moments, their down moments, their out of administration power moments, a chance to sit back, to think in these larger ways that are so significant and that are so incredibly hard to do when you're in office, when you're in the thick of crisis. And it's hard to set up the structures to have these big thoughts when every day is, you know, meetings and challenges and crises and unexpected things. So that's how I see our role as kind of academics and historians, is providing both some of the big picture and also some of the kind of practical space and time for those folks, in fact, to think through these issues.
That's a very astute point, Bev. I will say most of the people I know who go into government operate by the axiom that you operate in government with the intellectual capital you brought with you, that you're so busy on a day-to-day basis, it's hard to acquire new intellectual capital. I just want to close it out, Bev, by allowing you to do a plug. Again, you head up the Brady Johnson Program in Grand Strategy. Is there some place people can go online and see what it is that you and your colleagues are having students read about?
Absolutely. So if you plug in those terms, Brady Johnson Program in Grand Strategy at Yale, we've got a full website up there with our event schedule, but also our syllabi for the last several years, in the sense of kind of what ideas we deal with and how we manage to put Saul Alinsky and Clausewitz together on the same syllabus.
On that note, and with a strong encouragement to the listeners to check out that webpage and that very exciting syllabus, I'm going to close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guests have been Beverly Gage, Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University, Christopher McKnight Nichols, Elvis Sanders Eminent Professor in the Honors College at Oregon State University, and Andrew Preston, Professor of American History at the University of Cambridge. Chris and Andrew are the co-editors of, and Beverly is a contributor to, a new volume just out entitled Rethinking American Grand Strategy. Oxford University Press is the publisher. Bev, Chris, and Andrew, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks.
Hey, thank you very much.
Please subscribe to the Presence Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the Presence Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherland. As always, Zoe did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you very much, Zoe. Special thanks also go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.